Great start.
Oh, no.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the February 3rd, 2015 committee meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. I'd like to welcome all of our committee members, and in particular our new committee members. After we adopt the committee rules, I'm going to ask that each of us briefly introduce ourselves. And when I say briefly, 30 seconds is wonderful. Probably a minute is starting to stretch it. Your interest in this committee, so that our audience and the folks that are watching us by TV have a feel for who we are and what makes us tick on this committee. So with that, I'm going to open the organizational meeting, and have the committee members had an opportunity to review the committee rules?
Yes.
I think they're quite standard. Does anyone have any questions or issues with the rules as they stand presently? Seeing none, hearing none. Representative McLean, Vice Chair McLean, do you have a motion?
Chair Witt, I would like to move to adopt the proposed committee rules on this particular day, February 3rd, 2015.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2015. Is there any discussion on her motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Here.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Forsyth.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Hildreth Whitsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Excused.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. With that, the rules are adopted. Committee members, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. To kick it off, introductions. Again, I am Chair Witt, Representative Witt from House District 31. I represent all of Columbia County in the northern portion, probably north of Highway 26 is easiest to explain. In Washington County, a sliver of Multnomah County, past Sovies Island between them. I'm very interested in ag and natural resources. My district really was born of the traditional industries in our state, fishing, farming, and forestry, the three Fs, and those continue to be very important industries within my district. And with that, I'd like to turn it over, please, and we'll just go down the line. Representative Barreto.
I'm Greg Barreto, House District 58, and that is Wallowa County, Union County, and that part of Umatilla County from Pendleton up through Milton Freewater. And like Chair Witt, our district is rich in ag and natural resources, so cattle, ranching, farming, as well as timber.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen returns.
I return for another term, and I'm delighted to be here. This is my second term on Ag and Natural Resources. I'm Catty McEwen. I represent House District Number 9. It starts at the southern end of the city of Coos Bay and goes to the northern end of the city of Yahats, east into Scottsburg, not Wells Creek. I have 5 voters in Elmira. And a significant amount of the Coast Range. Of course, the district that I come from and my family is deeply rooted in the hunting and fishing, And of course, my district has the timber industry as a certainly a potentially large asset, fishing, mining, and agriculture to a certain degree up in our river valleys. We used to have a tremendous amount of dairy farming, and it's beginning to come back with third generation family members reclaiming land and doing a lot of organic dairy farming. We have a burgeoning industry in blueberries and specialty crops, cranberries, that serve us all well as export. So delighted to be here.
Very, very good, and we're delighted to have you back. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, which is Medford. I live in a county that has large amounts of pears and wineries. It's big time in our area. We also have fishing, some of the best fishing in the world on the Rogue River. We have migratory waterfowl, and I believe in hunting and fishing and trapping. I believe that it should be a privilege that we should cherish for our future generations. I'm also on the National Sportsman's Caucus National Board, on the Executive Council, and I've been privileged to, and honored to be the co-chair in the state of Oregon for the last four, five, six sessions, something like that. So glad to be here. I don't have one cow in my district, but outside the district, we have lots of them.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
My name is Susan McLean, and I'm from West Washington County, which is primarily Hillsborough, West Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian and was raised on farms in Marion and Clackamas County. The district that I represent, which is House District 29, is very rich in agriculture. We have high-tech, and we also have agriculture, and that balance is always an interesting discussion and a debate. And we have blueberries, we have hazelnuts, we have grass seed, and we have a lot of nursery, and so it's really always been important to really look at the natural resources that we have here in Oregon and try to make sure we use them well.
Thank you very, very much. I'm going to hold on Mr. Gallagher's introduction. He probably didn't know that I was going to ask him to introduce himself, so I'm going to give him a minute to collect his thoughts, but we're very fortunate to have him. Representative Frederick.
Hello there. Thank you. I'm Lou Frederick, District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland. And all of the natural resources, well, most of the natural resources that come out of Portland, out of Oregon, come through my district. I have said very simply that we need to reconnect the rest of the state reconnect the state. One of the people that I met many years ago said very simply that he was concerned because we no longer had a familial connection between Portland and the rest of the state, where at one time everyone in Portland had a relative who lived in Coos Bay or lived in Ontario. We no longer have that as the case, and that has created a problem for people understanding what's going on. I come from a very urban district. It is the smallest district, I think, in the state. I can walk from the north to the south of my district in about an hour if I'm not stopped by somebody to talk. I have a history of fishing and hunting in my family, but I also have a history of my father's a botanist. He's a mycologist. He was a sharecropper's kid, so I grew up going and seeing the sharecroppers working with family in Mississippi and Alabama and Missouri. And I also was a ranch hand for several summers in Nebraska. So I have some sense of what goes on, but I was a reporter for many years, and I got a chance to travel the rest of the state. So I've been in all 36 counties and enjoy that. So I'm really pleased to be here, and I think it's a perspective that I think is appropriate for this committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Frederick, and that perspective is very much appropriate and very much appreciated. And your ability to connect with rural parts of Oregon is something that I just admire. So thank you that. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. My name is Gail Whitsitt, and I represent House District 56, which is half the southern half of Klamath and Lake counties. So I share a border with California, which sounds like a long ways away from here, but it's our backyard, and a lot of our ranches and farms go into California. The owners are in Oregon, and half their places are in California. We are the largest producer of cattle in the state of Oregon, and cattle are one of the largest agricultural commodities that Oregon has. Combined with dairy, they rival anything that we have agriculturally. And I was raised on a large ranch in Montana, so my background is all ag, and I'm a geologist by profession, so I've spent a lot of time outdoors in my life.
Thank you very, very much. And along with Representative Barreto, Representative Gorsuch is a new member of this committee. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Chris Gorsuch. I'm from District 49, which is out on the edge of the east side of Portland. We used to have a lot of agriculture, but we grow more houses now than we grow crops. There is some. And in fact, Representative Esquivel, sometimes in Troutdale, there is a parcel of land that may have as many as five cows. So I have a little bit of background in that. I'm a teacher by trade. I teach at Mount Hood Community College and part-time at Portland State. And one of the things that I teach is geography. And so there's a lot of emphasis in my studies about natural resources. A course on the geography of Oregon, and really preach the need, like Lou was talking about, for the connection between rural and urban. My background is that my father worked in a pulp and paper mill for Crown Zellerbach at West Lynn, and my grandfather, born at a place called Svensson, up in the Coast Range near Astoria, and he spent a period of his life as a logger working up there. My grandmother was the camp cook for a period of time.
Woman.
So I have a strong interest in this, and my district sits next to major national forest lands, so I'm very interested, especially in forestry issues.
Representative Gorsuch, most people have never even heard of Svensson, let alone know where it's at. So thank you very much. Just outside of my district. So we're very fortunate to have with us today Senator Whitsitt. He is not the ninth member of our committee. Representative and Vice Chair Krieger has an excused absence this week. He's out on other business. But we will be hearing a couple of bills that are of interest to folks in the veterinary sciences. And Senator Whitsitt is an expert in that field. Welcome, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I do appreciate being invited to the committee this morning. I represent Senate District 28, which is five counties in southern Oregon, and my main claim to fame is my marriage to Representative Whitsitt.
Well done.
Thank you very much.
Dodge that bullet.
Boy, there's three points right there. Well done, Senator. Well done. And with that, thank you very, very much, committee members. And hopefully that's of interest to the public. And I'm going to close the organizational meeting. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2474. And Mr. Gallagher, I forgot your introduction. We're going to stand at ease on that bill, and we're going to have an introduction from Mr. Gallagher.
Well, I have had time to collect my thoughts. I am Chuck Gallagher. I'll be committee administrator for the session. I've enjoyed a 30-year career in agriculture and land use, but I've never worked with the legislature before, and I am just thrilled to be here. And my goal for the session is to serve as staff as well as I possibly can. So thank you for bringing me on board. I'm pleased to be here.
Thank you very, very much. And we are very pleased and very fortunate to have you on our staff. And committee members, as you get to know Mr. Gallagher or Chuck, I know that you're going to enjoy him very, very much. And with that, we're back on the record with House Bill 2474. And Mr. Gallagher, can you give us, please, the background on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, The measure requires veterinary facilities to register with the Veterinary Medical Examining Board and requires the board to adopt rules and fees for registering and reviewing facilities.
Thank you very, very much. And with that, we're going to go right into the public testimony. And with that, I'm going to call up, Lori Mackinnon. And Lori, and if you have anyone that you would like to bring up with you while you're up here, please feel free to. Folks, welcome to our committee. You are our first witnesses on the first bill of this session, so thank you. And please decide among yourselves who will go first. And please remember to introduce yourselves for the record before you begin your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lori Mackinnon, Director of the Veterinary Medical Board. And the board is proposing two bills for this session. 2474, as Mr. Gallagher indicated, gives the board the authority to register and regulate veterinary facilities, which is currently not something we do, although many other states in the country do this. The reason that we're seeking this authority is that over the years we've seen cases where veterinary medical facilities fall far short of the minimum standards. And what I've handed out to you contains just a few issues that can come to the forefront if these standards aren't upheld, such as air quality, lighting, potable water, waste disposal, things of that nature. We currently can only investigate a facility on the basis of a complaint, and we rarely get complaints about facilities because the only people that really see what goes on in a facility are employees or ex-employees, clients. You, as facilities, don't see what goes on in the back of the house. So we're seeking to do this. We have we plan to do most of the work in rulemaking so that all of the potential affected parties will have a voice. We're looking at a fee of $150. Hopefully, we'll be able to reduce that as time passes, and we have more potentially self-inspection processes in place. So that's pretty much what I have.
Very good. Sir?
My name is Dr. Tom Keck. I'm a practicing veterinarian just over the river at Dallas. I'm also a past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, presently on the board of directors of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and a past 9-year member of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The Oregon Veterinary Medical Association was involved in a work group concerning the issues that are in this bill. And in that bill, you know, in the work group, we came up with many different things that we generally agree with the intent of the legislation. We understand, and I especially understand, that the licensing board needs to have oversight over facilities, both those owned by licensed veterinarians and non-licensed veterinarians. We have had a change in the profession, and that change is that no longer are a lot of the practices actually owned by veterinarians. They're owned by corporations or owned by family members, and the board truthfully doesn't have any control over anybody but licensed veterinarians and licensed veterinary technicians. So the other aspect of this bill would be to allow the veterinary board to do away with the rules that require only veterinarians own licensed veterinary or own veterinary facilities. It would give the board the ability to regulate, as they should, for the protection of the people of the state of Oregon and our animals, non-veterinary owned facilities. We'd like to see this bill move forward, but with a few important changes. And suggested changes are in section 1.4. Notes that the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board may not define veterinary facility to include any established, operated, establishment operated by a government or not-for-profit organization. There was an agreement within the working group, which was convened by the examining board, to not exclude not-for-profit organizations. So we hope that would get amended and be included, because there are a number of not-for-profits that truthfully need to be regulated also. We understand that the examining board is seeking an amendment to change the language to only exempt governmental organizations. We agree with the suggested change, but are waiting to see the language until we can pledge full support. We will also be bringing an amendment that requires the examining board to convene a rule advisory committee to discuss and recommend languages for the rules that are being proposed in Section 3 of the bill. Although we've been represented during the two meetings of the working group, House Bill 2474 is a substantial change we believe warrants special attention and discussion by those varied facilities providing medical services to animals across the state, both urban and rural. And there is a dramatic difference between practices in Portland and practices in Baker and practices in Dallas, Oregon. We're quite a bit different because of the type of clientele we serve. With this in mind, we ask that the committee not move the bill while we draft the amendments and discuss with the examining board and our rural, urban, and not-for-profit partners these changes. And I thank you for your consideration, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very, very much for your testimonies. It's certainly appreciated. Members of the committee who have questions or comments, now would be appropriate. Representative Whitsett?
Yes, I was wondering how you propose to monitor mobile vet. There are a number of rural veterinarians that only work out of trucks. And, I mean, that's the full extent of what they have, because they serve areas of hundreds of square miles and they don't have a building. So how is that going to fall under this?
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Whitsett, that will probably be determined through the rulemaking process with input from those practitioners. We have a practitioner in Portland who his practice is a bicycle. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea at this point how that's going to look. That's why we want to have the rulemaking process to determine those things.
Thank you. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm just interested in what precipitated this conversation. Did something change? Were complaints filed? What brought us to this point?
Mr. Chair, members, I think it's his fault, actually. In 1990 or so, he proposed the current rule that requires that a practice only be owned by a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. And the impetus for that at the time was valid, but it hasn't done what it was intended to do, which was give the board authority over a non-veterinarian owner. So that's part of it. The other part is that, as Dr. Keck said, the ownership schemes have changed, and so when we have an out-of-state corporation that owns a practice, if that practice falls below standards, the only recourse we have is to go after a licensee who might be an employee of a corporation who has no control over or ability to meet the standards. So that's part of it. The other part is that it's the rule that we have is not enforceable, but we don't want to repeal it without having some ability to address non-compliant facility conditions.
Follow up?
Please, and if you have a line of questioning, continue.
So what I'm hearing you say is over time the business model has changed.
Correct.
Is that the problem that you're addressing? Okay. All right, that's helpful. Thank you.
If I can address Representative McCowan. Yes, the evolution of veterinary practice has changed in this state as well as nationwide. The costs of veterinary practices have gone up dramatically. And a lot of the situation has also been a gender change. More veterinarians now are women than men. More of them don't want to own practices. So we see now more corporate-owned practices. And truthfully, like was said here, the only recourse the board has at this time is to go after a licensed veterinarian, could not go after the facility, could not shut a facility down. Yes, I was the rotten guy that proposed things and caused all this problem many, many eons ago. But I realize that we've got to get this change because it's an unenforceable situation at this time. It also puts veterinarians, if they go to sell their practice and they are trying to sell a $2 million practice in downtown Portland, and Representative Frederick can kind of attest to this, there's not a lot of veterinarians walking around with $2 million in their pocket to buy a practice, but there are corporations that can get it done. And veterinarian feels guilty because he sells to somebody that the rules say thou shalt not. So we need to get that changed. And as Senator Whitsitt would probably tell you, you know, it's an unenforceable law, unenforceable rule. The courts would rule against the examining board if they went after somebody for not being a licensed veterinarian, owning a practice. They would go after them, and the examining board would spend large amounts of money and would lose. So it's the evolution of what has happened in practice.
Thank you. And with all due respect, Dr. Keck, as this is our first meeting, and I'd like to start it out well so the groundswell doesn't begin. It's McEwen.
Oh, sorry.
Once it starts off, it goes like wildfire, and everybody's wondering. It is McEwen. Thank you very much. You get a pass.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Representative Esquivel and Vice Chair McLean on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't the solution be easier to require any facility that has to do with veterinary procedures to have a licensed veterinarian? And they have to comply with state law.
That is correct. You are exactly correct. The veterinarian has to be licensed that's in that facility.
But okay. What you're telling me that you can't do anything with the facility, but you can the veterinarian.
That's exactly right. So here is the defense if you would go to site a facility for, let's say, unsanitary conditions. The employee veterinarian says to an administrative law judge, I'm just the employee. I got to have this job.
Okay.
Enforce it against
Follow
him.
Follow up, please.
Okay. And I can relate to this in the aspect that I'm a realtor, but every real estate community or entity has a designated broker, a primary broker, that is in charge and responsible for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can we not do that here? Wouldn't it be easier?
I don't believe so, sir.
Okay. Why?
Why? Really and truthfully, unenforceable. Because you may have a designated veterinarian. The only person you can punish is that designated veterinarian.
But
you can't do anything.
Charge of it.
You can't force the facility to change.
Okay. Interesting.
Vice Chair McLean.
I guess my question is for you as well. My understanding from the beginning presentation was that there was going to be rulemaking, and that basically through that process, the folks that you're talking about, including yourself and some of the issues that you brought up, could be addressed. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between, in your mind, an amendment and the rulemaking process?
Representative McLean, the rulemaking process is more flexible, also allows for changes quicker than by doing it by statute. That's one thing. I think the major thing is we need to have a licensing system for facilities so that the board has a handle on the facilities, just as the hospital board has a licensing ability on facilities. Yes, in requiring that physicians be licensed to practice in it. You have to have something on the facility itself so that you can enforce standards. Did I answer your question?
I think so. I guess what I'm saying is, can you show me in the legislation that we have in front of us where you, it looks to me, in my mind, that's what it was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you needing to add that allows you to have that certainty that you're dealing with the facility versus the actual veterinarian or the licensed personnel?
Well, by in the bill itself, by allowing for licensure of the facility, mm-hmm. or permitting of the facility, whatever the term may be used, then we have the ability to handle the facility, and then you have the ability under a separate set of rules, which are already in place, to handle the veterinarian that does something wrong. As it is now, the only handle the examining board has is to discipline a veterinarian.
Yeah, I get that.
They can't, if the veterinarian does not own the facility,
they can't
do anything.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative McLean, can
please.
I just jump in? If I understand your question, you're asking why further amendments might be needed in order to make this work. And the board has already requested an amendment to Section 4 in the definitions where public and nonprofit agencies are exempted. We're taking that out so that it will all be in rulemaking. And we didn't put it in the legislation, but the board intends to have a task group, just like we did developing to this point, to make sure that the rules represent the interests of all parties before we even get to the rulemaking process.
Does that help?
That helped, yeah.
Thank you. And for the record, that last testimony was from Ms. Mackinnon. I have next up for questions Senator Whitsitt and Representative Frederick on deck.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I actually have several questions. First, Tom, I kind of defined eons ago, unfortunately.
Both you and I.
Actually, we served on the board together.
Yeah, it's a scary thought, isn't it?
I sponsored a bill 2 years ago in 2013, Senate Bill 646, that was very similar to this. And the bill did not move out of committee primarily because we were unable to define, reach a consensus on the definition of a facility. And here we are 2 years later with a bill that just wants to do it by rule, and that makes me very nervous.
Senator Whitsitt, I understand your concerns. Now speaking as a member of the former member of the examining board, the advantage to having definitions done in rule by the board is it is more flexible, and as practices evolve and the profession evolves, things can change. 10 years from now, it is possibly thought that we will not even have x-ray units anymore in veterinary clinics. Actually, it will be new modalities that will be being used to accomplish what radiographs do now. If we have it somehow in statute that says you're going to have a definition that all facilities have access or have within them radiographs or radiographic units, you know, you're actually going to have to come back to the legislature and change that versus having it in rule, it can go through the board. I know people are concerned about rogue boards, and I know people are concerned about people on the boards with agendas. I will say that I am concerned with that also. That is why, you know, I was on the examining board for 9 years. We have to watch the boards and keep an eye on them. The Oregon Veterinary Medical Association does. We also have many people out there in the animal welfare community that do. And, of course, all members of the board, as you know, are nominated by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And I hope the Senate would check every person out like I was checked out when I was on the examining board. I think it's more flexible that the board have the ability to write the rules to define what practice is. Most states, there are exceptions, do that, and it seems to work. In addition, the definition of a veterinary practice or a veterinary facility has not been in statute for as long as the statutes have existed. And we haven't really had that problem with a definition there.
Well, with respect, you've never had the authority to regulate facilities.
Except for when the veterinarians own them.
And the other part of it is, you know, on that issue is that certainly that gives the board more flexibility, but certainly that's a two-edged sword as well. It's much easier to change a rule without most of the veterinarians in the state knowing it than it is to change the statute. But moving on, I certainly agree that the nonprofits should be included, because as currently written, it would write out the Humane Society's humane shelters, animal rescues, all kinds of things like that. In Section 3.2c, the way that it's written appears to give the authority to the board to establish whatever fee they wish to do for that facility. And it writes out the section, Tom, that says it, that the fee has to be only for the purpose for what it was only adequate to serve the purpose for which it was written. I'd like to see that put back in.
I have absolutely no objection to that as a former board member.
Okay. I think that should be put back in. It also makes me very nervous in Section 3.4, where it establishes authority for the board to suspend or revoke a facility registration for any failure to comply with an as-yet unwritten rule adopted by the board. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a little too flexible for my taste.
Actually, that is the same basic rule that is applied to veterinarians in the statute, that the veterinarians have to comply with any rule that is presently there or any rule that would be futurely written by the board. Mm-hmm. So it's no real change mm-hmm. as veterinarians versus facility
The existing statute makes me nervous, too.
And, well, if you want to propose changes to existing statute other than these, Senator Whitsitt, I'm open to looking at them.
I did confer with legislative counsel at some length, and he actually convinced me that the board does have authority to initiate an investigation on their own authority.
That is absolutely correct. And, I will disagree with my former administrator to my right. The board did and has done investigations of its own volition, not based on complaints. The best examples I have are examples of where the Drug Enforcement Administration gets a hold of the board and says, guess what, we got a problem. That ain't a complaint, that's a report.
Okay. And those are my primary concerns, other than the relating to clause is relating to veterinary medicine, really? that's sort of a drafting thing that I don't believe. You can't change it now. But, I mean, in the future, I would certainly recommend that you be a little more specific. You could drive a truck through this with relating to a clause. I guess in total, I'm just concerned that we're, instead of writing a statute, we are authorizing the board to do all this by rule. And that's in a nutshell.
Senator Whitsitt, if I can say something, that the bill that was proposed 2 years ago that you sponsored, I found much more palatable than what we've got now. But what we've got now is what we can work with. I liked your bill much better, sir.
We can fix that.
Senator, I don't want to speak for Representative Esquivel, but I know he has a puzzled look on his face, and he and I don't understand. We're not accustomed to rulemaking violating the intentions of legislation that comes out of the House side. So is this a problem over in the Senate?
No, not at all. I'm just concerned that a statute as this one is written gives the board carte blanche to write whatever rules they wish to and then enforce them in any way they want.
Well, thank you very much for making sure that those concerns are expressed, and I don't, for the record, want to misportray Representative Esquivel's feelings on some of this. So, I suspect there may be some of us that share, perhaps strongly, your concerns. With that, committee members, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Chair Witt. I am curious about taking the nonprofits out of this. This was I'm not sure why that took place. Can you give me
some reasons for why that was, why that happened, and I understand the reason, at least I think I get an idea of why we might need to have them in that, but why was, after the working group came out, why did they decide that this was appropriate?
Chair Witt, Representative Fredericks, and members, it was suggested that the bill wouldn't go very far if that language was left in, and so the board decided to seek an amendment, simply removing that sentence and leave the process up to rulemaking. The board has, the goal of this is to make sure that any facility that offers veterinary services to the public meets minimum standards. How we get there, again, will be determined in rule. It's not the board's intent to foreclose anybody's options for veterinary care, whether it's in a standard facility or a shelter. So again, we feel that the rulemaking process leaves the best options for a flexible approach to how different facilities are defined. And I would also like to say back to Senator Witsit's comment, the board does have authority to launch an investigation on its own against licensees, and facilities are not at this point licensees. And I would also like to say, and Tom, I think Dr. Keck can back me up on this, is in the 18 years that I've been doing this, the board has never attempted to make a rule that subverts a statute or that doesn't have the support of licensees and interested parties.
As to your question about the not-for-profits, I think part of the problem here was, I think legislative council somehow put that wording in, and that ended up in your lap, and that's why we've got to take it out. In the working group, the not-for-profits that were present all agreed that the rules should apply to all veterinary practices, period. And we do understand that the governmental part of it can kind of get into a mess with certain statutes. And at this time, there's, to my knowledge, only two governmental practices in the state. One is Oregon State University, the College of Veterinary Medicine. And if they have problems down there, we got a lot of problems. And then there is a spay-neuter facility, I believe, operated by the city of Eugene that has been there for a number of years. And so the not-for-profits at the time, and there will probably be some that will testify here, were on board with that, saying, yeah, we've all got to be treated the same.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, are there any final questions or comments of this panel? I'm not seeing any. Administrator Mackinnon, Dr. Keck, thank you both very much for your testimony and for taking our numerous questions. We certainly appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'd like to call up, please, Sharon Harmon, Scott Beckstead, and if you have anyone else that you would like to invite up with you, please feel free. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
And welcome back to our committee.
Good morning, Chairman Witt, members of the committee. I'll find my voice here. I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society, and we're here in support of House Bill 2474. I couldn't agree more with Dr. Keck's assessment that the field of veterinary medicine is changing rapidly. It wasn't too long ago when shelters did not have professional veterinary staff. Now it is a board-certified profession within veterinary medicine to have shelter medicine as a profession recognized. For our hospital at the Oregon Humane Society, the Animal Medical Learning Center, we employ 5 full-time veterinarians. We treat 15,000 animals a year. We're also an American Animal Hospital Association accredited facility. Less than 15% of the veterinary clinics, for profit or not, reach that level of accreditation. There are only 12 in the United States that have achieved that level. We are also an American Veterinary Medical Association accredited teaching hospital with our partnership with Oregon State University, where all fourth-year veterinary students are required to complete a course in primary care at our hospital. They actually live there for 3 weeks while they do this course. We've graduated our 500th veterinary students since we opened in 2007. 10 years ago, who would have ever imagined that? Our partnership was the first in the country. It's a model now replicated in 54% of the veterinary colleges in the U.S. I agree that we need to keep the rulemaking flexible. I also agree, but I'm only speaking for the Oregon Humane Society here, that we feel nonprofits should be at the same playing field as for-profit veterinary facilities. I think the existing law just doesn't quite keep up with the times requiring only veterinary ownership. We need to recognize the landscape and allow that flexibility. And we'd appreciate the opportunity to be treated just like everyone else. So that's my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director and Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States, the nation's largest animal protection organization headquartered in Washington, D.C. We have state directors in most of the 50 states. I'm their guy for Oregon, a position I've held since 2008. For those of you that are new to the committee, just by way of background, born and raised on a working farm in southern Idaho, raised on horseback, showed beef, steers, and dairy heifers. I hunted throughout my youth and childhood. So the issues that this committee is going to be dealing with are issues that are often very near and dear to my heart. But here in support of House Bill 2474, we also believe that it's important for nonprofit clinics to be subject to the same rules as other veterinarians. But I do want to register our concern, and I think, Representative Frederick, that you kind of touched on this. We view the nonprofit shelters as an important player in providing veterinary services to pet owners. And in particular, we understand that many underserved communities get a lot of benefit from nonprofit shelters. So while we support the Dash 1 amendments, we want to make sure that it doesn't become a slippery slope where it becomes harder and harder for these nonprofits to provide services to communities, and particularly communities that may not have the ability to afford services from professional for-profit enterprises, if that makes sense. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Representative Whitsitt, please.
I just have a concern that I want to express, if we go down the rulemaking path, what may be considered traditional veterinary practices in rural parts of the state, i.e. docking tails, branding, dehorning, may be considered by individuals who are making the rules as inhumane or work to shut down practices that do these things in the rural parts of the states on cattle. And so I'm really concerned about if we give a body the opportunity to decide what is good for the rural part of the state that's based in Portland or Salem or Eugene, that we're going down a road that we don't want to go down because somebody may decide that that's just not what we want, and it will reduce the veterinarians that we have and the services that we have out in eastern Oregon, where it's really hard to get veterinarians anyhow. And sort of to follow up on that, in these mixed animal practices that often a single veterinarian has, you know, say out in Burns or Ontario, you know, cattle and horses are in the same facility as dogs and cats. And when you're dehorning a cow or, you know, doing something with a large animal, you can end up with manure from one end of that building to another really, really easily. And so, you know, if you've got one vet and a helper or two, and you have somebody come out and take a look at that clinic at any given time, it could not look really sanitary, but in fact it is by the end of the day, et cetera. So I'm concerned about mixed animal practices and somebody coming in and saying, well, this isn't hygienic enough, and that's what we've got. We can't get vets out into this part of the state, and they have to make do with what they do. And so I'm just really, really concerned about letting a body make decisions in an urban part of the state for the rural part of the state. And I understand about hygiene and the whole thing, but I mean, it is just different out there. As I said, like with, you know, mobile practices, single little facilities that are one or two rooms. So anyhow, thanks.
Thank you very much. I don't know if either of you care to comment. Don't feel pressured to do so.
Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, I participated in the work group sessions, and your concerns certainly weren't part of the discussion about how to limit veterinary practice. It was about regulating veterinary facilities and who gets to own them and who's responsible for the care within them. If the legislature wants to go a different direction, that's your purview, but it was not discussed within the work groups I participated in.
Representative Witsit, I think you bring up some very good points. I suspect that dehorning and docking are often done with a purpose. It's not just something that we do for doing it for the sake of doing it. Thank you for that commentary. That's, I think, a very important consideration that we need to add to this debate. Vice Chair McLean.
The only question I had was, in listening to your testimony, my understanding is that you are in favor of the amendment that's been drafted, which would take out and online on one of the lines, and then nonprofits on line 15 and 16. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, that is correct. We support the Dash 1 amendments. We will be watching the bill to make sure that it doesn't further erode the ability of nonprofits to provide services.
Okay.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public that would care to testify today on House Bill 2474? I am not seeing any. Just so that everybody's on the same track here, we have been requested to hold off moving this bill. We're only in day two of the legislative session, although I think it feels like week two. At least it does for me. And so there are some folks who haven't had an opportunity this early in the session to be able to come up to speed with where the committee is at least on the fast pace that that we've been on. And in addition, I have been advised by Senator Witsit that the bill would be well served if we had some amendments. I take his advice and counsel to heart. And with that, we are anticipating amendments to this bill. I typically, folks, as we move through the session and everybody has had an opportunity to take a look at the legislation, would hope that we don't have last-minute amendments to bills. Now, sometimes it can't be helped, and sometimes it's the difference between make or break for what would otherwise be a good bill. But please, let's all try and get our work done in advance. And I understand that in this instance, it probably wasn't possible. With that, hearing no one else wishing to testify, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2474. And bear with me while I shuffle the paperwork here. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2475. Chuck, if you could tell us a little bit about this bill.
Chair Witt.
Yes.
May I ask a procedural question?
Please.
and maybe I'm not using OLIS correctly, but sure. It's helpful for me if I have a witness list in front of me so I have names I can identify with the people that are coming to address us. And I'm looking in the meeting materials, and I'm not seeing a witness list, and I'm not seeing the names on our agenda. Is it
yes.
possible that... that I'm missing something?
Well, no, Representative. And this is, I share your concern or what you would like to have happen. Procedurally, we have a sign-up sheet in the back of the room, and people sign up right before the hearing, and sometimes literally as the hearing is going on, they hear something that they want to respond to and dash up and sign up. Sometimes they actually go up to the committee assistant and say, this is something I got to jump on here right now. So procedurally, it's difficult for us to go from that instantaneous sign up to letting us know, and we don't always know in advance literally who's going to show up to testify. So
I'll try and take better notes.
Okay.
Thank you.
And if anyone has a better idea, I am more than happy to accommodate, because when I am a committee member and don't have the benefit of the list in front of me, I share that. So let me know if somebody comes up with a better way.
We shall make do.
All right. Thank you. Chuck?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure authorizes the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board to impose a fine of not more than $100 on any permit or license holder regulated by the board for administrative or clerical violations that don't create risk of harm to the public.
Thank you very much. And do we have a witness sheet for this one?
We do.
Did I steal your sheet?
Yeah, we're finally here.
Thank you very, very much.
Sorry.
Here we go. Thank you. And again, I would like to invite back, please, Director Lori Mackinnon and Dr. Tom Keck. Welcome back for your repeat performance.
Good morning. I'm Lori Mackinnon.
I apologize.
And if somebody mentioned Svensson, I believe I probably have relatives up there.
I suspect. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the board is proposing House Bill 2475, which will give it the ability to write what amounts to a traffic ticket for very low-level infractions of the Veterinary Practice Act. The benefit to this will be saving time and effort that the board now undertakes to deal with these minor violations. It will also keep the matter out of the public domain for a veterinarian. The board doesn't feel that minor infractions need to be on a veterinarian's public record forever. And an example of a minor infraction would be, for example, failure to notify the board of a change of address, failure to post a license in a facility. Again, this bill has the support of OVMA, and I hope still happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Keck?
My name is Dr. Tom Keck, practicing veterinarian and member of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association Board. We're in support of this bill. It's a practical matter. The legislation provides the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board the discretion to impose a modest fine against a licensee who is in violation of just an administrative rule when they are minor in nature and do not pose a risk to the patient or to the public. We also understand that a veterinarian who is presented with this situation can still ask for a public hearing and go through the normal process. Speaking as a former board member, there were many a time where you had situations where there was a problem with records, a minor problem with records, God forbid we couldn't read them, things along those lines that we just basically, you know, the animal was taken care of properly, but we just needed to be able to understand what was going on and to have the ability to say to somebody, hey, improve your records, you know, make a point with the $100 fine. It's just a logical method of handling it. There was no risk to the public, no risk to the animals, versus going through the whole process of having something show up on a veterinarian's record, you know, with the examining board, that they'd had a violation when their care was perfectly fine. So the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association is completely in support of this. It is a long time coming. I sat there on the board, and I wish I would have had this in my hand when I was on that on the examining board. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate both of your testimonies. Committee members, do we have any questions of our panel on this one? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I just wanted to put something on the record. In talking with the Legislative Council, this bill does not point out where the fine goes to, where the money goes to. And in talking to Legislative Council, existing statute directs the money to the board, and it also limits the amount of money that the board can charge it can't be greater than is required for its purpose. So, I mean, I think it's pretty well covered to keep them from using it as a fundraiser.
Right.
And for that reason, I support it.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that that commentary. Additional questions? I'm not seeing any. Folks, thank you a second time very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
That was way too easy.
and with that, I am inclined to go into a work session, committee members, on this bill. Before I do, by way of explanation, just kind of procedurally here, some of the returning members are familiar with this. Representatives Barreto and Gorsuch may not be, but I rely very heavily on the vice chairs. In this instance, it would be Representatives Krieger and McLean as vice chairs to check in with the committee members. To see if folks are comfortable moving legislation before we do. I know that Representative Krieger has been out, but hopefully folks have had an opportunity to read through this bill and feel relatively comfortable with it. And so I would encourage the committee members from this point forward, work with the vice chairs. If you have concerns, don't ever hesitate to talk to me. But I rely very heavily on our vice chairs for that, and please feel comfortable going to them. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2475, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2475. Committee members, I'd like just to take a moment for any of you who have questions or concerns about this bill to present them before we possibly entertain a motion to move it out of committee. Anything from the committee members? Seeing none, hearing none, last and final call, I'm going to, Vice Chair McLean, you have a motion?
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2475 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2475 to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? Seeing none, hearing none. Committee members, in lieu of having to call the roll, I think this is a simple, straightforward one. Is there any objection to her motion? Seeing none, So adopted. Thank you all very, very much. The motion passes. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2475. Committee members, good work. We've already got a bill out of committee. Thank you very much. I'm going to open. Jump the gun. Reopen the work session on House Bill 2475. Is there anyone who would like to be a carrier of that bill?
I'll take it if you need me.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel will be the carrier. I appreciate that. Thanks for volunteering. Close that work session on House Bill 2474 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2432. Chuck, what's this bill about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the measure increases damages for unlawful taking or killing of wildlife, creates a rebuttable presumption of intent to sell, barter, trade, import, or export wildlife parts, and establishes penalties.
Wrong bill.
We get
Wait a minute.
Hold on, folks.
My apologies. Yeah. Well, that was a rough start. Let me start over again. House Bill 2432 expands the list of lands on which fireworks may be used to repel birds and other animals, and requires that fireworks used to repel birds or animals be purchased from wholesaler and properly stored.
Thank you very much. Interesting topic, fireworks throughout the year, possibly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chuck, very much. Let's see here. We have on the witness list, excuse me, folks, this didn't come through to
is that Anita Phillips.
Anita, okay. Anita Phillips, please. I'm sorry, the carbon didn't come through. Here we go. Office of State Fire Marshal. Anita, and let's see. Why don't we get Sharon Harmon and Scott Beckstead up here, too? Bill, yes.
Not the firing line.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate your willingness to testify in the bill. Please decide among yourselves the order of your testimony.
You're first.
Okay, I'm first. Okay, good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Anita Phillips. I'm the License and Permits Manager at the Office of State Fire Marshal. I'm here to provide information on House Bill 2432, which expands the use of agricultural fireworks to other businesses that have demonstrated a need to protect their property from damage caused by birds and geese. So House Bill 2432 is a result of collaboration between the Office of State Fire Marshal and various stakeholders, industries, businesses, to allow them, businesses such as golf courses, landfills, farms, and other entities, to use agriculture fireworks to protect their property with respect to other state and federal law, as indicated in Section 2, Sub 3 of this bill. I would like to tell you that up until 2010, our office did issue agricultural fireworks to golf courses and landfills. That had been a practice for many years, and someone had actually challenged our authority to issue those to golf courses and landfills, and upon research, we found that we shouldn't be. So therefore, we're trying to basically kind of get back what was lost and any other businesses that have demonstrated a need to use them. This bill also adds clarifying language to require agricultural fireworks to be purchased from an Oregon wholesaler and be properly stored. Those requirements are there now, but we're just going to clarify it a little bit. There are no fees associated with obtaining agricultural fireworks from our office, and all the other requirements that are currently in place will remain the same. All permit applicants are expected to follow federal, state, and other local laws in place, including the prohibition of the use of agricultural fireworks on federal and state and private forest land protected by Oregon Department of Forestry when those agencies enact a ban for use during fire season. Agricultural fireworks are an effective, non-lethal way of scaring away birds that damage property. They work by being launched into the air. Once they get up in the air, they'll make a bang, a crackle, or a whistling effect, which will scare the birds away. We request your support on this bill, which will assist Oregon businesses, and if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you very, very much. I think before we proceed, I am going to possibly take a couple of questions here if anybody has any to this point. I actually have one or two. Now, will the department be providing these fireworks, or is it just the permit and then I get to go some wherever I go to a fireworks distributor and purchase those?
Chair Witt, there's the process for obtaining agricultural fireworks is we have a one-page application, and basically what the applicant does is work with a game management agency, federal or state, and they assist them with what types of devices they can use for hazing. And so if they recommend agricultural fireworks, then they will sign off on the permit, and statute requires that we have that sign off before we can issue the permit. Then once they get the permit, they need to purchase their fireworks from an Oregon wholesaler that sells agricultural fireworks.
Okay.
And they're different than regular fireworks. You don't see any big colors or anything. It's just a small bang or whistle or crackle.
Okay, very good. And now, is it possible to haze? Does this legislation provide for hazing for any other animals besides birds?
There is another statute following that talks about predatory animals.
Okay.
And that's a whole different thing from what we're trying to update here.
I see. Okay, so if the elk are coming into my pasture and eating all of my oats and tearing down my fences, we still don't necessarily have an ability to haze them?
I apologize, Chair Witt. You do have the ability to haze them with agricultural fireworks.
Okay.
I was talking about predatory animals like cougars and things like that, but yes.
Very good.
This does give everybody the ability to do that.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Representative Esquivel.
I can wait until the whole panel's if you
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I had one question, and that is, I know over where we are, as Chair Witt mentioned, there are elk issues, and they do use the firecrackers or the shotgun, and they also use guns in the field, propane guns. And some of these farmers have them. I mean, they purchase them, and they use them regularly. Do they have to check or get a permit from the fire marshal also, as well as working with Fish and Wildlife, or does Fish and Wildlife have the authority to go ahead and give that okay without the fire marshal?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, the way the statutes are set up now, it requires a game management authority to sign off on our permit. It's a relatively easy process. It's just a one page and no fee. but the statutes require us to know that there is an actual demonstrated need for it. If there's not, then it doesn't get signed off by the game management authority and we don't issue the permit. The process for obtaining that permit is, again, to contact the game management authority. And they are, at this point in time, still required to obtain fireworks from an Oregon permitted wholesaler. However, the federal and state authorities can also, like Department of Fish and Wildlife, can also provide fireworks to their people they're trying to assist.
Okay. Representative Esquivel, followed by Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long does this process take? If I had a field with grass in it, let's say grass seed, and I had a couple hundred geese come into that field one day, how long would it take me to get through this process that you're explaining with ODF&W and what have you, the bureaucracy, in order to acquire the permit? Because by the time, if we're talking 2, 3, 4 days, 5 days, more longer, I could lose my whole crop. How is that? What time frame are we talking about?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, once we receive a permit, it's our goal to turn it around that day because we do recognize there's oftentimes an immediate need, such as wineries or people growing grapes. The birds are attacking the grapes, and they need it now. But the process, again, though, is to work with game management to find out what type of hazing would work best for that situation. But as soon as we get it, we do make it a priority.
So you're saying it's within 24 hours?
Yes.
Okay.
Weekends.
Representative Whitsitt.
Yes. I was wondering if there's a heat component to the fireworks that we're talking about here. I understand the propane guns, you know, I've seen them used for predators, primarily with sheep, to drive off coyotes, and they work somewhat. But when you're talking about fireworks, are we actually talking about the possibility of something that's hot enough to start a fire during certain times of the year, depending on the area that they're, ejected into?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, fireworks, agriculture fireworks are a lot different than regular fireworks. They're not the same. Often some of them are like a cartridge, like a shotgun cartridge. And basically, if it's going to make a bang, it goes up in the air and it just produces a little bang.
Okay.
You know, it's nothing spectacular, but it's just enough to scare the birds away.
Heat component. There's nothing that can catch on fire in any capacity.
There is. Fireworks are labeled as a 1.4 E, which is low explosive. Same thing as what 1.4 G is for, like consumer fireworks, but they're packaged different. You know, they come in boxes. You don't light them, but again, we also require that fireworks are properly stored, and you have a correct place of storing them, not with other combustibles or sources of ignition.
Okay.
Ms. Phillips, just so that perhaps for further clarification here. Is part of that permit, if it's during the height of fire season, does the department take into consideration the potential fire hazard when it makes that permit out?
Chair Witt, what we do is we issue a permit if it's signed off by the game management authority, but we also reference that people need to follow the federal, state, and local laws. So if the BLM or the Department of Forestry enacts a ban on the use of those during fireworks season, then people are expected to follow that.
Thank you. That's helpful. Vice Chair McLean.
The question that I had, it looks like the only types of permits that you've given up to this point were either on the recycling and waste facilities, the landfills, or the golf courses. So do you have an estimate of how many types of these permits you think will be requested a year?
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, when we had previously issued permits for golf courses and landfills, the last count we had was 32. And with, of course, it's just an estimate, but with these additional uses, we don't expect it to really be more than 50. And that's on a three-year cycle. So we've made the permits valid for 3 years. So it's more convenient for the permit holders, and it also streamlines our processes to better serve the customer.
Thank you.
Representative McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Witt. This is fascinating. I want to follow up on what Representative Esquivel brought up about the timing of a permit and then what the extent of the permit. So if I'm a farmer and I have a liability, something's occurring on a Saturday morning, is your office open to get a permit turned around on a weekend? And second of all, once you get a permit, can you hold those materials for a future event? For example, if your grapes are coming on and you have an issue that comes up during a particular day and you address that issue and 2 weeks later it happens again, can you purchase enough materials and store them to get you through a season? Is it one permit over a period of time, or is it one permit for an event?
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, as far as open on Saturdays, no, we're not. But I do have a pager for other fireworks issues. We would try to address that the best we could if there was an immediate need. But the way the permit works is you put in what type of crop or property that you're going to be protecting. And then it's up to you to figure out with the game management how many you can get. So you can purchase as many as you need for that permit, and that lasts 3 years. So you don't so you don't have to keep going back and getting them. You get what works for you.
All right, follow up. So what I hear you saying is the farmer or the rancher can anticipate what's going to happen and be prepared for when the event may occur.
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, you're correct.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Very, very good. Additional questions or comments? Our other two panel members?
Go ahead. Members of the committee, my name is Sharon Harmon. I'm with the Oregon Humane Society. We are supportive of non-lethal options for reducing wildlife conflicts. Our concern is that when you expand the number of places that can be used and the inevitable conflict between residential uses and commercial uses and where they abut, and is there an opportunity for folks who have, you know, where these fireworks are going to go off, and it's a residential area. They have pets, and pets can be terrified of fireworks. They not only live in terror, they can escape, they get out on freeways, they hang themselves over fences. I mean, the impact of trying to flee the sound of fireworks can just be devastating for the animal and for the family that owns them. And I'm wondering if there's a way within the permit to at least to have some ability to address those concerns as a community, as opposed to one entity doing it and being blind to the needs of others in that location.
Thank you very much. And I think that is a very important concern and consideration. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director and Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here to support House Bill 2432. We as an organization endorse the concept of the increased use of non-lethal methods to address wildlife conflicts, and because this bill does that, we would urge a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Questions of our two recent panelists, or our first? Ms. Phillips, what about the public's ability to express concern that a permit may be terrorizing the neighborhood dogs that go out and they run away, they run in front of cars because they're so panic-stricken. Every 4th of July we hear the litany of stories about the family pets that end up being lost or some tragedy befalls them because they're so panicked over explosions. Is there any consideration, any avenue in the legislation or within the department, for me as John Q. Citizen to say, you know, my chickens have ceased laying eggs because they're so terrorized?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, first I wanted to point out that there has to be a need demonstrated to a game management authority. So these fireworks would not likely be used in areas where there are residences.
Okay.
And the other thing is, these are totally different from the big explosions that you see. Yes, they'll produce a bang or a whistle or crackle, but they're not comparable to regular fireworks.
All right. That's helpful. Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if this would then fall under the right to farm aspect that we have in the state. It's just a question. I don't know if you can answer that. If we pass that, or what is the recourse now? Are people allowed to shoot birds out on these farms? I mean, what Scott was saying, I really agree with. I'd prefer not to shoot the birds. I'd prefer to scare them. And so I was wondering, is the alternative then shooting them?
Do you care to comment?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, I don't really know what the laws are pertaining to killing animals or birds.
I don't want to put you in that position either. I apologize. Yes, Representative Barreto.
I just have one question. Thank you, Chair Witt. One question, and maybe it goes back to the previous testimony, but if you were trying to streamline this operation, say you just Fish and Wildlife would give you a permit to do this, and especially in our area, a lot of this happens in the wintertime when there really isn't any fire danger, if you could bypass, or you could just give authorization to Fish and Wildlife so you didn't have to check with two agencies, especially like on a Saturday.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, that would require a statutory change to take us out of the equation and just make it between Fish and Wildlife and the applicant, if I'm answering your question correctly.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate it. I'd like to call up next, please, Jenny Dressler and Roger Martin. Welcome to you both. Roger, we don't get to hear from you too often in this committee. Beauty before age this morning.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding House Bill 2432. Over the past few decades, the number of geese wintering in Oregon has increased substantially, today numbering over 400,000 geese. Canada geese arrive in October and they'll stay until May. And the entire time they feed on crops, including grass seed, wheat, and clover, among others. In 1999, Oregon State University study estimated the damage to crops damage to crop yields of approximately 25% due to goose damage. In the Willamette Valley and elsewhere in Oregon, pyrotechnics, like these fireworks, are an important tool to haze geese and limit crop damage. To this end, Oregon Farm Bureau is supportive of House Bill 2432, which expands access to fireworks as a tool for hazing avian predators. However, we are concerned that increasing demand for fireworks will impact the supply available for hazing on agricultural lands. Currently, there are only two licensed wholesale firework distributors in Oregon, one in Canby and another in Ontario. Oregon Farm Bureau is concerned that expanding access to use fireworks for hazing in a short time frame could create a shortage of fireworks to haze birds on agricultural lands and increase crop damage. Result in crop damages. This issue was a significant concern for our members of our Oregon Farm Bureau Wildlife Committee, many of whom have seen increasing instances and severity of crop damages in recent years. The goose population is healthy and depredation costs farmers a significant amount of money in hazing and crop losses. Oregon Farm Bureau members ask for certainty that fireworks and other tools will continue to be available to allow them to effectively haze geese and prevent crop damage in their fields. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I look forward to continuing this discussion as the bill moves forward through committee.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Good morning, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm here representing the Oregon Golf Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before this committee. I want to thank Anita Phillips of the Fire Marshal's Office for her foresight in starting this whole process behind this bill over a year ago, so everyone that had some interest could put input in it. She's gotten a lot of suggestions. I bring about three areas of my own personal life to this in observation. Since early childhood or early teenage, I have been a golfer, a hunter, and a fisherman, bird hunter. I've observed Oregon wildlife for longer than most of you have been around here. The issue, and Jenny said Canadian geese arrive in the fall. We have about a half a dozen mm-hmm. subspecies of Canadian geese that many of whom have become residents of this state. They formerly did migrate, as Jenny said. Now they just live here year-round because we have provided them with their very habitat they love the most, plenty of grass and plenty of open water. Every time a gravel pit is dug out, it fills with water, and this city itself is resident to thousands of the subspecies of Canadian geese called the dusky. And all you have to do is drive out State Street and visit the Lottery Commission's office, and if you do, be very careful and watch where you're walking because it's covered with goose poop, and they're there year-round. Now, I'm not here to testify the lottery needs this, but golf courses do. Up until 2009, we could use a device called a banger. A banger, and this I'm reading from the sheet, bird bangers, bird repellent explodes with a loud report which scares off problem birds. Time-delayed charges explode about 75 to 100 feet downrange. The interesting footnote on this is caution. This device cannot be sold or shipped to Alaska, Hawaii, New Jersey, or Oregon. All the other western states and all the states surrounding us allow this. My golf course superintendents, and it was exemplified by one of them over in Juniper Golf Course in Redmond, he said, I had a wonderful opportunity, wonderful way to chase the geese away when I could use the bangers. In the last 5 years, I've only had my anger to be able to drive them away because it's very frustrating. Geese will land on a golf course and leave the same thing they're leaving out at the Lottery Commission all over greens and the golf course, and it's very difficult. I've observed Canadian geese for years. They're tough, they're ornery, and they're hard to get rid of, but they will fly away if you go bang over their head. Now, we've talked to our golf course superintendents and pointed out that if you have a residential golf course like McNary Golf golf course out north. You better be careful about the residents who live there, because if you misuse these and too much, they'll be complaining louder than the problem with your geese. So we're used to what we have to do, and we urge you to pass this legislation and put us back in the same category of states all over the rest of the West. The other area, and I have to say it, if Representative Krieger were here, he would tell you, please do this, because the problem on the Oregon coast and our estuaries with cormorants, and also on the Columbia River with Caspian terns, those are two non-native species that prey on the downstream migrants that the state of Oregon spends millions of dollars, along with the federal government, in our hatcheries. And many of them are lost to these non-native species. They just prey on them, and there's no way to chase those away now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer
any questions. Thank you very much, Roger. I certainly appreciate both of your testimonies. Does the committee have, yes, Representative McEwen, please.
I would be happy to channel my colleague, Representative Krieger, today.
Hey, very good.
With a quote that he would be using if he were here, to your point, Mr. Martin, that I believe the number is $250,000 worth of salmon smolts are eaten in any given week on the Columbia during the season when the fry are migrating. And it's very concerning, and I know he would be championing this bill. So I will sit in his stead today.
We're missing Bill Cluding today as well, who also expresses that concern to this committee on a very regular basis. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Whitt. I've overstayed my invite, but
on
cormorants, the second largest breeding colony of double-crested cormorants on the entire west coast of the North America is in on Upper Klamath Lake.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right there where we have the endangered suckerfish.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a coastal issue. And the second comment, it has to do with geese. You know, a Canadian honker will eat about a pound of grass or grain or whatever a day, which is about the same amount as a yearling calf will.
Wow.
So if you've got 10,000 geese in your field, it's the same as having 400 cows in there. It gives you some idea of the waste that they can lay to a grain field.
Absolutely. Any other committee members? Roger, you mentioned the Henri Canada. if you've ever driven down past the prison when they've decided that they're going to cross the street, they generally are in no hurry. thank you for that. Seeing no further questions or comments, thank you both very much. Is there any other member of the public that would like to testify today on House Bill 2432? I'm not seeing anyone. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2432. And committee members, we're not in work session, but I'm not sensing a lot of heartburn. If there is, you can express it here in a moment. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2432. Committee members, this would be an opportunity before we entertain a motion to express that heartburn or concern. I'm not seeing any. Vice Chair McLean.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2432 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much, committee members. Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2432 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? I'm not seeing any. And once again, with your permission, committee members, to save a little time, is there any objection to her motion? Seeing none, hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, committee members, very much. Is there anyone that would like to carry the goose and other feathered and furred?
Fine feathered friends?
Yes.
But I might suggest that Representative Krieger might enjoy carrying this bill.
Oh, he's not here. What a wonderful suggestion.
In fact, we'd volunteer him for any work group or anything.
Boy, this is going to be a long work session here. Thank you very much, Representative Krieger. Representative Krieger will be carrying that. I will close the work session on House Bill 2432. At this point, anything for the good of the order of this committee? Do we have anyone have any announcements to make? We have something coming up with a Sportsman's Caucus here in a bit.
Yes, we haven't determined yet, but it looks like a week from Wednesday morning we're going to have a breakfast downstairs, and all is welcome. Right now we're approaching 40 people in our caucus, which makes us the largest caucus in the building. And so we'll go forward and see how we do. The other thing is that we were very blessed this last year on having the first time the National Sportsman's Caucus annual meeting, and it was in the first time in the West Coast, and it was at Sun River, and we had 23 states attend. So good show.
Tremendous. And he's much too modest to say it, but much of the success of that caucus is due to Representative Vescovel's very good and very hard work in that regard. So thank you for that. Any other announcements? I'm not seeing any. Chuck, would you tell us a little bit about coming events?
Thursday, 8 a.m., we are meeting for a public hearing and possible work sessions on three bills, HB 2537, which I have to apologize. I tried to introduce earlier in this meeting.
Well,
but we'll get a chance to do that on Thursday.
Very good.
That increases damages for unlawful taking or killing of wildlife. House Bill 2453, which requires organizers of large gatherings on state lands to get a permit with the State Forestry Department. And House Bill 2452, which would abolish the Fish and Wildlife Deferred Maintenance subaccount.
Thank you very much. There you have it, audience members. Be here or be square on Thursday. Thank you, committee members. We got two bills out already. Appreciate your good work. We stand adjourned.
Nicely.
We stand adjourned.